This is Jim Inkster coming today on Talk Louisiana. We will visit with Jacob Bernstein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. He will discuss his analysis of offshore networks uncovered by the Panama Papers. Bernstein will also comment on the friction that is existing between the media and the White House and the mantra of fake news from President Trump, who is now in day 333 of his administration. Also, Pat Forbes, the Executive Director of the Office of Community Development, and Keith Cunningham, Executive Director of the Louisiana Housing Corporation, they will talk about the comeback from the historic flood of 2016. Many in our community are still afflicted by what happened in August of last year. Now 16 months removed, how are things looking, and how is the prognosis for 2018? Now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us today. And later in the show, we'll visit with Pat Forbes, the Executive Director of the Office of Community Development, and Keith Cunningham, the Executive Director of the Louisiana Housing Corporation, on the comeback from the historic flooding of last year, 16 months removed. How's it looking? We start with Jake Bernstein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist and author. He previously worked with the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, and during a quarter-century career, he's covered the Civil War in Central America, industrial pollution in Texas, political corruption in Miami, system crash and greed on Wall Street, and the secret world of offshore money. And that brings us to his most recent book, Secrecy World: Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Good morning, Jake Bernstein.
No, good morning, Jim. Thank you so much for having me.
My honor. And if you'd like to talk to Jake, 877-217-5757, or locally in Baton Rouge, 297-5633. And you could send an email, if you prefer, to talk@talklouisiana.org. How significant is this Panama Papers investigation?
It was hugely significant. It had impacts all over the world. It, for the first time, really showed this underground economy through which trillions of dollars flow. A lot of this is completely legal, tax avoidance, and quite a bit of it is illegal money laundering and tax evasion.
And you won the Pulitzer Prize for your investigative work as part of an international team of reporters who broke the story. Was it surprising even to you that you found so many troves of information?
Yeah, even to me, it was surprising. I mean, there were more than 11.5 million documents in the files. The law firm Mossack Fonseca, this Panamanian firm, one of the top five incorporators of anonymous shell companies in the world, at least it was at the time, and they had been operating since the mid-1980s, and so they just had a ton of clients, including people like the Prime Minister of Iceland and the President of Pakistan and Ponzi schemers and criminals in the United States and the Minister of Industry in Spain. I mean, all kinds of people had been using this service.
And it turned the British Virgin Islands into the biggest tax haven in the world. How did this work?
You know, Mossack Fonseca was one of the companies, I mean, that really put the British Virgin Islands on the map. Up until then, into the mid-80s, it had been sort of a sleepy chain of islands that was known for tourism and maybe a little drug smuggling. And it passed this company incorporation law that was actually based on Delaware's company incorporation law. And this law allowed people to incorporate companies and not really with many questions asked as to who actually owned the company. And so Mossack Fonseca saw this as a great opportunity, and they started using the BVI to sell these companies, because at the time, other places like Panama, which had been doing this business, had sort of fallen into disrepute because of Noriega and other sort of scandals. And so they really began to push and market the BVI, and it ended up pumping out hundreds and hundreds of thousands of anonymous companies that were used throughout the world.
We're visiting with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jake Bernstein. His latest work is Secrecy World: Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. You note that the United States Internal Revenue Service has been ineffectual in stamping out offshore abuses. How much of a thorn in the IRS's side is this scandal?
Well, it's a huge problem for them. And they have not been great about going after offshore tax evasion. And part of that is because the offshore tax havens don't really cooperate with the IRS. It's hard to get the information. And it's costly. And, you know, to the IRS's defense, recent Congresses have just radically pared back their ability to act on this matter. I mean, they've cut down on staffing. The IRS has reduced its staff dramatically. The folks who are in charge of investigating this kind of stuff have been fired or have left. So, you know, it just hasn't been a priority. And because of that, billions of dollars by corporations and by individuals is held offshore, and that's money that's not being spent on infrastructure, on schools, on police, on healthcare here in the United States.
Generally, what is the most common way that the ultra wealthy use these offshore accounts to evade taxes?
Wow, I mean, there's lots of different ways to do it, right? So it begins with, you know, setting up structures offshore in places like the British Virgin Islands or Bermuda or Jersey or the Seychelles. It could involve creating an anonymous offshore company and a trust or a foundation or various versions of all three so that you can layer your structures, make them even harder to penetrate. And then they open a bank account. Used to be in Switzerland, now it might be in Dubai or Hong Kong or Singapore or the Bahamas. And then the question is, how do you get the money back to you in the United States, right? And there's lots of different ways to do that. The credit cards are one way. Another way is to lease things back to yourself or to sell things to yourself at a loss. I mean, there's lots of different scams that are typically used. The IRS knows about most of them. They just don't actively prosecute as much as they should.
Are we talking trillions of dollars?
We are indeed talking trillions of dollars, ultimately. Now, the vast preponderance of that is from corporations. The U.S. loses, by one estimate, about $70 billion a year in tax revenue just from shifting corporate profits to tax havens. And then individuals are billions of dollars more. So, I mean, to give you a sense of the scale of this, Delaware gets more than $1 billion a year from its business registry. So that's just pumping out these anonymous shell companies. And they, you know, the U.S. government has complained that Delaware is used by Russian and East European criminal gangs and all kinds of scamsters and criminals all over the world.
Well, Jake Bernstein, you note that this has tentacles far and wide, including the rise of Vladimir Putin. You say this is connected in some way to the Panama Papers. How so?
Absolutely. We found a collection of Putin's closest friends, including the godfather of his eldest daughter, who happens to be one of Putin's oldest friends, is a classical cellist who had, before the Panama Papers, nobody knew that he had any business dealings at all. In fact, he had professed that he was not a businessman. And yet we found him being the ostensible owner of several anonymous offshore companies that were involved in very, very sophisticated and expensive financial transactions. So altogether, we found a collection of offshore companies connected to Putin's oligarchs and the people closest to him, childhood friends, through which billions of dollars flowed and through which they got massive loans from state-owned banks. So this was really the closest. I mean, there's been rumors for years that Putin is, in fact, a billionaire, if not a trillionaire, and that he has gotten all this money from state banks and from state companies and from a piece of every major business transaction that happens in Russia, but no one has ever been able to prove it. And the Panama Papers really was the closest that anyone has ever come.
The book is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. The guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jake Bernstein. A question from a listener at talk@talklouisiana.org. Is there any indication that President Trump is involved in this at all as a business person?
That is a great question. So I found as many as 9 of Trump's foreign business partners in the Panama Papers. And these are people from Azerbaijan, they're from Turkey, they're from Canada, they're from Indonesia. And a picture begins to emerge of the kinds of people that Trump was doing business with. And these are people who have been accused of tax evasion in their countries, have been accused of prostitution, have been involved in all kinds of secret dealings. And this perhaps should not be a surprise, because Trump himself admitted that he had more than 515 companies, and 378 of them were registered in Delaware. So these are people who know how to use the offshore system, who kind of make their own rules. They're not governed by the rules that govern all of us. I mean, Trump himself bragged in the debate that he was smart to avoid taxes. So, yes, this says, I think, quite a bit about Trump and how he operated and how the people he did business with operated.
We're visiting with Jake Bernstein, and we will take a short pause, but there is still time to get in if you'd like to pose a question to this Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. 877-217-5757 is the number. We're talking about his book, Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. This had implications worldwide. The Prime Minister of Iceland resigned. We'll talk more with Jake Bernstein after this 90-second pause on 89.3 WRKM. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. And our guest is Jake Bernstein for another segment, 877-217-5757. His work is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Jake won the Pulitzer Prize for his work in 2017. He also won in 2011 the Pulitzer for his work called The Wall Street Money Machine. And was it a leak of some kind that was the catalyst for this groundbreaking story? What got you on the trail, Jake?
Yes, it was. It was a German newspaper in Munich called Süddeutsche Zeitung got contacted by an anonymous leaker who asked them if they wanted data. And they, of course, said yes. And then this data started to arrive, first in a trickle and then in a torrent over many months. And Süddeutsche understood that they couldn't actually go through all this data by themselves. So they contacted the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, which has hundreds of journalists that it works with all over the world. And together, we did this year-long investigation into these Panama Papers. I was contacted by ICIJ to join the team fairly early on. I got a call from a friend of mine who said, we have something interesting we think you'd be perfect for, and I can't tell you about it on the phone. So I had to come to Washington, D.C. and meet with ICIJ, and they told me, and I signed on right away.
Well, you also note that the CIA had its first secret bank accounts. What's the story behind this?
Well, this is a wonderful story, because it's sort of classic bureaucracy, right? This is in the 1950s, and they have all of these covert agents, secret agents, and they realize, how are we going to pay these people? You know, we can't. There's too many of them now to work in cash. We can't just be handing over suitcases full of cash all the time. So we need to create secret bank accounts. Well, how do we do that? One of the ways we do it is we create fictitious people and fictitious companies, and they in turn open these bank accounts. And they went through this whole process, and of course, because it's a bureaucracy, they had plenty of meetings, and the meetings were all documented with memos and things like that. And over time, that stuff has become declassified, and I found a bunch of it in the CIA's archives. And it really shows how both the CIA and the KGB and pretty much every major intelligence service has used this system of tax havens and secret bank accounts in places like Switzerland in order to do their covert operations.
877-217-5757 is your number. And our guest for a little while longer is Jake Bernstein. Another question about Wilbur Ross, the Secretary of Commerce. Is he immersed in this in any way?
Absolutely. Now, after the Panama Papers, there was another leak of information. This one touched an offshore company, called Applebee's, which is based in Bermuda. And Applebee's sort of more high-end. It did more work with corporations. Was not quite as colorful as the Panamanians. And one of their clients was Wilbur Ross. And Wilbur Ross had a whole system of offshore companies, including one that was perhaps not properly disclosed when he was disclosing things to become Commerce Secretary in the Trump administration. And this one that was not particularly well disclosed ends up doing business with Vladimir Putin's son-in-law, among other people.
Now, this, of course, is a big story, one of the biggest in the last few years, and now we have this mantra of fake news out there. Are you concerned that stories like this may not get the attention that that is warranted based on people's inclination not to believe what they read and hear and see?
You know, I think the truth will come out. You know, sometimes it's a drip, 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 but you know, you cannot deny reality forever. And so, you know, the wonderful thing about the Panama Papers was there were so many reporters working on this. There was so much cooperation. We didn't just take the documents on face value. We corroborated them with court cases and with interviews and with other documents in the public record. And so you get this preponderance of evidence, and it becomes harder and harder to deny that this is actually happening and the existence of this stuff. So, yes, I think that in part the reason why journalists are under such attack right now is because there's a lot of uncomfortable information out there that's making people unhappy. And it's in some ways a signal of the fact that the people are beginning to see this stuff and to recognize it. So, yes, I think it's a problem, but I'm not pessimistic about it.
You are optimistic that despite the fact...
I am optimistic.
Go ahead. Why?
Yeah. Well, because, you know, I think that if they're not attacking you, you're doing something wrong, right? I mean, the mere fact that there is so much great investigative journalism out there right now is a sign of, A, that there's a lot to investigate, you know, and the fact that there's a need for... You know, social media, the president now goes on Twitter, and he has to constantly attack CNN and the New York Times and the Washington Post and lots of other media organizations as fake news. Well, why does he have to spend so much time doing that? It's because they're reporting stuff that he doesn't like, that worries him. You know, that directly contradicts what he's saying is in fact the truth. Mm-hmm. And the fact that he needs to do that is a sign that those reporters are doing their jobs, and that this information is getting out there. So I don't see it as a sign of strength. I see it as a sign of weakness. And I think it's a good indication your journalists are doing their jobs, and that the facts are getting out, that they have to constantly call it fake news. Now, a certain proportion of the country is going to believe that stuff. You know, they're in their own little silo. They're not thinking critically. They're not looking at a wide diversity of facts and viewpoints and media. And that's always going to be that way. There's nothing we can do about that. Those people are hard to reach. But there's lots of people, I think the majority of people, who genuinely want to know what's going on, who think critically, who are willing to investigate and look at different media sources, and not just one, but multiple ones, and sort of judge for themselves what they think is really going on. And I think that's just going to increase. So I am optimistic.
Well, what is being done to address the prevailing issue with these investments that are tax dodges abroad. Is anything being done in our country to make sure this is curbed?
Well, that's an excellent question. So the Republican Congress is on the cusp of passing a ginormous tax bill, and they're saying that by lowering the corporate tax rate, that is going to end up curtailing to some degree corporations using this offshore system, that they're going to repatriate their money. There's not a lot of evidence for that. It certainly hasn't happened in the past when they've cut corporate taxes. So we're just going to have to wait and see. Unfortunately, this tax bill opens up lots of other avenues for people to scam the system and also to use the offshore system. So we're just going to have to wait and see. Up until now, there's been, you know, a few efforts. The Obama administration did some things, but the reality is that the forces that want to keep the status quo or even increase the loopholes and the ability to hide offshore are strong. They include secretaries of state in places like Delaware and lawyers and accountants and bankers. And so it's going to be a constant struggle for people who want more transparency in this system and who want you know, everybody to pay their fair share and operate under the same system of rules.
Well, Jake Bernstein, congratulations on your groundbreaking work, Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite, from this journalist who has emerged as one of the great watchdogs in our country. 15 years ago, I think we talked when you were at the Texas Observer, so keep up the good work, Jake.
And thank you so much, and it's been a treat.
Happy holidays. Take care, my friend. And we'll be back after this time out. We'll talk about the comeback from the flood of 2016. Now the news with Karen Henderson. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana 1 week before Christmas Day. Hope you're having a festive holiday season. And Ali Baltazar is producing. If you'd like to give us a call, it's 877-217-5757. And talk at talklouisiana.org is our email address. We're 16 months removed from the historic flood of 2016, which ravaged our community. Many people have come back bigger and perhaps better than they were before, but others are continuing to try to make the best they can do under difficult circumstances. And we're going to discuss this in our remaining time this morning. Keith Cunningham is with us right now. He is the executive director of the Louisiana Housing Corporation. He's been in his post for about a year and a half, and good morning to you, Keith.
Good morning.
Well, how is it out there right now?
It's an opportunity. There are struggles there that still exist for people who were impacted by the 2016 floods, and we're looking to constantly create program and structure around creating opportunities for those individuals' housing needs to be met. So this is just one example of efforts by this agency in partnership with Office of Community Development to create programs that help those individuals impacted by the major disasters of 2016.
And we should be joined in short order by Pat Forbes, who's the Executive Director of the Office of Community Development. But right now, what is the major initiative as far as helping people?
Well, this initiative is really a continuation of strategies and housing concepts that we've been working through, things that we've learned from past disasters to help us try to achieve some housing. Right now, we're focused on the Restore Louisiana Piggyback Program, which is really an opportunity for us to leverage some of those federal disaster dollars with some of the state dollars to create more housing available for both affordable and market rate component.
Well, tell us about that program, though, Restore Louisiana Piggyback Program. How does it work?
It's a $33 million program. Application process started December 15th. We'll be taking application all the way until March of 2018. It is a program designed to create affordable housing and market rate component housing in those areas that were impacted by the floods and in areas that have the highest rent stress for the state of Louisiana, impacted by the flood as well.
And for those who wish to apply for assistance, how do they do it, Keith?
Well, this is more of a developer side component, so the developer community will be able to work with this agency to find funding to create housing development, additional development, and repairs on developments that already exist that are not in condition to house individuals now.
All right. But for those who wish to contact you, what's the best way to do it?
Definitely the best way to do it is both our website, lhc.la.gov, or our phone number, 225-763-8700.
You might want to say that again.
225-763-8700, and the website is lhc.la.gov.
And we're also joined by Pat Forbes, the Executive Director of the Office of Community Development. Pat's been with us before, and Pat, the last 16 months have been an adventure for you.
Absolutely. Adventure for Office of Community Development, but more so for the people of the state of Louisiana who are making their way through the recovery from these floods. And so we've just been trying to do everything we can to make that as easy as possible.
I asked Keith about how things were looking. Based from your vantage point, how do you see it?
I think that it is, I have said this before, it will never be fast enough, Jim, but I think that we are delivering programs faster than people have done that before, which is, we're doing everything we can to speed people's recovery, and it takes longer than it should.
What's the biggest obstacle right now?
Right now, if we think about the homeowner program, our challenge right now is getting people to complete their application. By Wednesday, we will have invited every eligible person to come in and complete the application for the homeowner program. And right now, we've only got about half of those who are eligible and have been invited have submitted that application. There are a lot of potential reasons for that. One reason is a lot of people think that when they completed the survey, that was the same as the application. This is a second step in the process that we put in to speed it up. So we just want to make sure if anybody thinks they've completed their application and isn't quite sure, they should just go check in with the Restore program folks and make sure.
And how do they do that?
That is 866-735-2100.
866-735-2100.
I'm sorry, 2001.
Gotcha, 2001. 866-735-2001. That's where you go. But the survey was unveiled, and I'm sure there some have probably thought, well, I did that, and now let's see what happens. But you say there's another critical step that's a necessity.
Right. So we put the survey in place for several reasons, one of which it sped the program up, believe it or not, because it let people sign up without actually applying so we could go do the environmental reviews before they ever applied. It makes a big difference in the CDBG world when you do that environmental review, and we didn't want to slow people down on rebuilding their homes. But the next step is completing that application, and you can also go into one of our housing assistance centers. You can do it online. Many people complete the entire application online. So you can also go to restore.la.gov and complete the application yourself.
I've heard that one a few times, restore, yeah, restore.la.gov. Now, there's some big success stories out there, and there's some people who are whole, and they probably have homes now that were nicer than they were before. How did they do it?
Well, we obviously had to deal with a lack of adequate funding, for one thing, for the program, and so we had to set up a way to do this efficiently and inexpensively if possible. So we defined what the materials and the standards of construction would be, and our contractors go out now and build that level of construction for folks. You're right. Some folks, it's going to be nicer than what they had before, but the main thing for both families and neighborhoods is getting people back in their homes so that we don't have neighborhoods that are checkerboarded with some folks not coming back. One thing that we were able to do earlier this year was increase the rebuilding money from 50% to 100% for everybody. So that means nobody should face the dilemma of having a grant from us but not being able to finish their home.
Mm-hmm. And you're working, I presume, hand in glove with our friend Keith.
Absolutely. We've worked closely together for years and years now, and this is just the latest in a long partnership that we have with Louisiana Housing Corporation. They are the housing experts in the state, and we are happy to rely on them to run the programs for us when it comes to these rental housing programs. They've got all the information. They got the tools. They got the people who know how to do it, and we're thrilled to work with them. We do it all the time.
877-217-5757. If you have a question about what's happened to the money that you think might have come or should have come, and you're waiting to know, this is the opportunity to talk with two experts, two people who are on the front lines of the comeback, Pat Forbes of the Office of Community Development, and Keith Cunningham, who is the man who heads the Louisiana Housing Corporation. And listener Tracy at talk@talklouisiana.org asks about people who have rental units. How do they apply for assistance?
And we have a number of programs that have been offered for rent-based assistance that's run through our programs, Louisiana Housing Authority. Specifically, again, that is an approach of just calling our numbers. Once you call our numbers and tell us what kind of need and what kind of impact you have, we're trying to channel you into the right resource, whether that's a homeowner or a renter. What we recognize is the 22,000 mm-hmm. people that were impacted, the renters that were impacted after the flood, are what we're working on to ensure that those individuals have their housing needs met as well.
And there are some block grants available, aren't there?
That's correct. LHC is also running a neighborhood landlord program that provides grants to folks whose rental units flooded during either of the March or August floods, and it helps them rebuild. And what the landlord provides in return is affordable rental for a period of time. Right. So it's a good deal. It lets people get their property rebuilt, and it helps us address this issue that Keith was talking about earlier, which is this terrible dearth of affordable rental housing.
Well, when you survey the landscape, are most people back to where they should be, or is there still work to be done in most cases?
Oh, there's always still work to be done. Yeah, Jim. What we have noticed in the homeowner program, I'll let Keith speak to the rental side, but in the homeowner program, we have noticed that the people of Louisiana are an extremely resilient lot. By the time our program got to vast majority mm-hmm. of people, they were over halfway done with their home, and that was just using either their FEMA money or SBA money. Some had insurance, some didn't. But friends, family coming over to help, they've one way or another have gotten a long way in rebuilding their homes.
And for renters?
For renters, it's been a hit-or-miss situation. It depends really on how the apartment complex was impacted. It depends on the nature of the insurance. We've seen evidence where some apartment complexes are still struggling with trying to determine what that cost component is for that replacement. But we've also seen some move aggressively forward. This is our opportunity to help those individuals who are needing to come back, who want to make mm-hmm. these necessary repairs. This gives us just another opportunity to assist them.
877-217-5757 is your number if you'd like to join the conversation. We'll spend some more time with Keith Cunningham, who heads the Louisiana Housing Corporation, and Pat Forbes, the man who runs the Office of Community Development. And we're back after this two-minute timeout on 89.3 with more Talk Louisiana on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana on WRKF. Ali Baltazar is producing, and your number is 877-217-5757, locally 297-5633, or talk@talklouisiana.org if you'd like to send an email. Pat Forbes of the Office of Community Development, he heads that organization. He is with us, and Keith Cunningham of the Louisiana Housing Corporation. Again, 877-217-5757. Toll-free wherever you are, and Allie says Jack in Panama is calling. Jack, Good morning. You're on Talk Louisiana.
Yes, good morning. Well, the people who took out SBA loans, I think kind of getting penalized a bit with the Restore Louisiana program because the amount of money received from FEMA plus the amount of the SBA loan is being subtracted, I believe, from any monies that you might receive from Restore Louisiana. And I was told that they are trying to work with whoever they have to work with to clear that problem up. But could I get your guest to explain where that all stands right now?
Thank you, Jack.
Sure. This is Pat. Thanks for the question, Jack. Yeah, that is a huge deal. It has been a huge deal for the governor since the beginning of this. But the federal regulations right now require that any money that a person receives for the same purpose is considered a duplication of benefits. And for whatever reason, the federal government considers that SBA loan identical to a grant, which we have made the case over and over again. That's ridiculous. There is some traction now. Congressman Graves has a bill in Congress to reverse this with the next appropriation, the next disaster appropriation. So we have great hopes that this problem will be fixed at the legislative level in Congress in Washington. But for right now, our hands are really tied. If in fact we get that relief, which the governor has worked very hard on, the congressional delegation's worked very hard on, we will likely be then asking for some additional funds as well. But we agree completely it doesn't make sense to punish people, if you will, for getting the loan and getting their home rebuilt. And so we've been doing everything we can, the governor and the congressional delegation, to try to reverse that, get it fixed. Mm-hmm. And get the money in place so that we can help folks who got a loan, too. Can't tell you how many people we've run into who were retired, had their house paid off, and now all of a sudden they got a 30-year mortgage and trying to figure out how they're going to manage that.
All right, Keith?
Yeah, absolutely. Pat said it absolutely correctly. From what we're understanding, those issues are being observed and they're being monitored by the governor's office and our friends at Office of Community Development. We anticipate seeing some major significant changes going on in how they allocate disaster dollars and how those disaster dollars impact communities.
Mm-hmm. This was supposedly a 1,000-year flood, but how are we positioned if something like this were to happen again?
Unfortunately, Jim, we have not been allocated adequate funding for the infrastructure enhancements that would put us in a better position in the future when the next floods do come. We have managed to use a few different funding sources, including some of these disaster funds, to start look at watershed planning. We think that's absolutely critical that we start to look at watersheds instead of jurisdictional boundaries. They're doing that in Acadiana. We've got an initiative here on the Amite River Basin and starting one in Monroe as well on the Ouachita and Beff. But until we can get some substantial funding to do infrastructure, it's just going to be planning at this point. Now, there is the president's suggested budget for disaster included $12 billion specifically for infrastructure enhancements. Mm-hmm. So we intend to compete for that if that makes it into the bill.
877-217-5757 or talk at talklouisiana.org. In our remaining time with Keith Cunningham and Pat Forbes, and this one is for you, Keith, from Sean, asking about how mortgage rates are affected by the Fed's recent moves to up the interest rates.
Well, everything is on an increase, a slight increase, which actually gives us the opportunity to run some additional programmings that we operate at the Louisiana Housing Corporation in our single-family mortgage revenue bond program. We're able to offer assistance, mortgage rate assistance, at a cheaper rate than the market, and we're able to provide closing costs and down payment assistance as well.
What's your rate?
Our rate right now, and we update that rate every morning, and I do not have it with me, but we can definitely make sure that your show has it before the end of this telecast.
Right. But it's lower than the going rate.
It's lower than the going rate.
And how does somebody apply? I mean, how are they eligible?
Again, this is for us, it's a first-time home buyer's concept. There are also some unique opportunities for those individuals who live in impacted areas based on the flooding. And so they just contact our website, again, lhc.la.gov, or call that number, 225-763-8700.
All right. Now, earlier, Pat, you said only about half the people who are eligible have applied for what's available to them. How do you see the next 6 months evolving?
A lot of construction going on. We're really getting ramped up now in terms of getting money in people's hands. They're paying their contractors to get the work done or using our contractor. In January, I will tell you, we're going to have a very big outreach of event or string of events to go get those folks who have completed the survey. We know they're eligible, but they haven't done the application yet. So I'm sure you remember this summer we had a big push to get people to complete the surveys. That was very successful, got a lot of people into the system. Well, now we've got to get them to fill out those applications, and so we'll be doing big outreach in January.
877-217-5757. I did want to note, Keith, that something that you have stated in the past that I think is worthy of noting is that our homeless population has decreased significantly over the last 5 years. How has that been achieved?
That's been achieved by a lot of hard work from a number of different partners. We've been working with HUD and local units of government to try to address the homelessness situation in a more complete and strategic manner. The continuum of care, which is a program we operate and run through our Louisiana Housing Authority, has been essential in joining people together and tracking homelessness across the state. So we've been able to kind of come to a zero neutral kind of sum game in our housing situation. And we're very concerned that the flooding is going to have a negative impact as it relates to homelessness, because dollars that were meant to help the homeless were moved around to try to assist people who had need, and we just don't want to, we want to make sure that those individuals who are homeless don't fall through the safety nets that we have designed to help them.
But Pat just said that we don't have the resources we need in any number of ways, and if we were to be afflicted with the same kind of calamity again, it would be another mess, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So one of the concepts and one of the strategies is to provide that additional housing, is to develop housing in such a robust nature that even as we have these disasters, we have additional places or additional opportunities for people to call home.
As far as the capacity for housing, how is it looking right now?
So far, we have not seen a huge stretch on the contractor pool or on the materials pool. There are a few specific places where it hit us pretty good, but by and large, we've got adequate capacity for what we're doing right now.
All right. A listener asks about FEMA trailers. Are they all gone now?
They are not. This is not my area of expertise, but if I recall correctly, I think there are some 2,400 folks, families still. In MHUs, and what recently happened, GOSEP requested an extension for the MHUs from March out for three additional months. That was granted, but FEMA insisting still that those folks pay rent after the end of March. GOSEP has appealed that and is still waiting for an answer.
2,400, so we're talking about a good number of people. What about hotels? Are there people still in hotels?
We've been doing a number of different events and activities to try to ensure that those populations, those hardest to serve, that were still staying in hotels, were getting their needs met. There still is a small segment, we believe, that may still be having use or needing those hotels, but we've been working tirelessly with FEMA, with HUD. The latest of those efforts was the Housing Resource Fair. The last one was conducted in Hammond. We've housed a majority of the people who had those
All
systemic
right.
needs.
Quickly, Brian in Prairieville, you're on the air with us. Hi, Brian.
Hello. I was just calling. I've worked with several organizations on the rebuild side and assistance side from the nonprofit arena. And one of the major challenges has been trying to find housing for those who were living in mobile homes that were not able to be rebuilt. And I know there is a program within restore.la.gov.
Okay, what about those people?
People who lived in a trailer that flooded and got major severe damage, we replaced the trailer. If it was a single wide, they can get up to $45,000 to replace it, and if it was a double wide, I think it's $66,000.
But you've got to apply, right?
You have to apply.
And if you haven't applied, You can't just wait for somebody to knock on your door.
That's right. You need to go to restore.la.gov or call 866-735-2001 and make sure that you have an application in place, and if you don't, get it done.
That's restore.la.gov and 866-735-2001. And that's it for today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For Ali Baltazar, I'm Jim Inkster. Thank you for listening to Talk Louisiana, and stay tuned.